Happy Saturday afternoon, everyone. John Hanson in for Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. We got an abbreviated show, so we're going to jump right into things with Rob Kelter, senior attorney for the ELPC, which is the Environmental Law and Policy Center. Rob, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so we're going to be talking about electric vehicles, short as EVs, as you call them. And you just took a nice walk through the auto show, and what did you find?
Found a lot of exciting new cars, great features, higher range before you need to charge. It's just a really exciting time for electric vehicles.
When we talk about EVs, that hybrids are a completely different animal, right? We're talking about solely cars that run just on electricity.
Well, there are three different kinds of cars.
Okay.
There are the hybrids that you think of, like a Prius. There are cars that just plug in and are totally electric, but then there are cars that plug in and are electric, but also have a gasoline backup system.
So all those fall under EVs?
Well, the ones that have an electric system that plugs in at all, those two, whether you have a gas backup or not, those are both EVs.
And when you walked through, you saw it was like what every single manufacturer had an EV for display.
Almost every manufacturer, and some had more than one, and the features on the electric vehicles are better. Every year there are improvements, and they become more mainstream. The charging range gets better. It's just a really exciting time for electric vehicles.
Do you see that consumer excitement building as well?
You do, especially with people who have the cars. They love them. They're easy to drive. They're very low maintenance. They're very low cost. You can save about $800 a year on gas if you drive 15,000 miles a year. So everybody's been thrilled with them.
What is the cost differential right now? Are we pretty much at even with normal cars, like gas-guzzling cars or whatever it is, or is there still a pretty significant gap?
I wouldn't say it's significant. I'd say there's still a small gap, but that gap is really reduced by the $7,500 rebate that you can get from the federal government.
So if the prices are getting close and it's saving you $800 in gas if you drive 15,000 miles, what's the holdup in this really becoming the majority of cars that we buy moving forward? Because do we have a percentage of what percentage of electric vehicles are vehicles sold right now?
It's still very low, but I think they're becoming more mainstream. We need more charging stations. There are already about 400 charging stations in the Chicago area, public charging stations. I think most people don't realize that it's easy to charge your car at home. You don't need a special charger. You can use your wall outlet.
Really?
You can get a special charger for a couple $1,000s. Different utilities around the rebates have different utilities around the Midwest have rebates for those. We're working with ComEd on that. But you don't need a lot of charge to drive 20, 30 miles to work.
Yeah, I wonder about, and we talked about this before we went on air, gas prices, because there was a time where everyone was so concerned about gas prices, and every now again in the summer it'll peak up, or when they change from the winter blend, everyone worries about the gas prices for a little bit. But overall, they've been tracking very low. Is that hurting electric vehicle sales?
You know, it doesn't help. If gas prices were $4 an hour, I think the market transformation would move faster, but we just need to get more charging stations out there and do more to promote these vehicles. They're really great. People love them. They're quiet. The acceleration is great. The features are great. They're just fantastic cars.
What more can politicians do, our leaders do, to encourage more electric vehicles to be bought? Or is it a matter of letting the market take care of itself, because this is the trend in which it's going?
Well, some of it's up to the market. Some of it, I think, is up to us. We're starting to talk to ComEd about a program for the Chicago area where we would make sure that there are charging stations along freeways to give people more comfort. I think there's some, we call it range anxiety, where people are a little bit concerned that they'll run out of battery juice. And the truth of the matter is that these cars can go anywhere from 150 to 250 miles without a charge. And that's more driving than most people need to do. But for people who want to drive in between cities, let's say Chicago to St. Louis, we're going to make sure that there are more charging stations along the freeways.
Are there any federal policies that are in place right now that are debilitating the growth of EVs?
I don't really think so. I think that, you know, I, I'm I wish more people knew that you could get a $7,500 tax credit from the government if you buy an electric vehicle.
I didn't know that.
That's a big deal.
On your next year taxes, you just get $7,500 on a credit?
Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that, but not
much. Wait, tax code more complicated?
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, you've got to demonstrate that you have one.
Right,
but
right.
It's not much harder than that.
What's your put? I mean,
and one other point I want to make about these. They're a very low maintenance, and the maintenance is inexpensive. So, you know, now, you know, if you've got a traditional gas vehicle, you're getting your oil changed every couple thousand miles, and you've got constant repairs going on. It's not that way with electric vehicles.
As we look forward to, are there any new exciting technologies that you think will help continue the growth of EVs, maybe that you saw at the auto show that aren't quite on mainstream market yet, but that you see coming in the next couple of years?
Well, the batteries are getting better and better, and the range will be greater and greater, and you'll need to spend less time charging your vehicle. But some of that market transformation has already taken place, and the charging has already gotten better. So if you drive, say, 25 miles round trip to work, all you have to do is plug in your car to a standard outlet at night, and it'll charge for you in a few hours.
I had one question earlier about the myth of our infrastructure not being able to handle electric cars. I told this to my family last week. I was like, I was in Washington 8 years ago, and everyone was worried that if everyone charged their cars overnight, it would ruin the grid. That is a myth, right?
That is a myth. We do encourage people to charge at night. Illinois has a lot of wind power. It's very inexpensive, and there's plenty of wind at night, and it actually works out really well for Chicagoans because Illinois has so much wind that blows at night.
Rob, we could probably talk about this for the entire show, but unfortunately, we got to get to our next guests. Rob Kelter, senior attorney of the ELPC. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, John.
All right, more coming up in the Winter's Business Lunch after this on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, John Hanson in for Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch on a average temperature sort of Saturday. People still bundled up, but certainly it could be worse. We know that here in February. Joined next by Rachel O'Williams and Kelly O'Cambry. And when I chatted with you guys just a couple days ago for TV, I let in that the O stands for O'Neill, and it's because you both share that name because you're mother-daughter, right?
Yes, we are.
And Kelly and Rachel, thank you so much for joining us. I'm going to start with your mom, Kelly. I'm going to start with Rachel.
Because
Rachel,
with me.
Yeah, because it all starts with you. Because your background was in journalism, and that was the field you worked in. How did you get connected to eventually build this STEM education curriculum? Where does the story start?
Well, as you know, what we've done is we've actually perfected a way using our puzzle piece characters, Paige and Paxton, to teach very complex STEM concepts to kids as young as 4 years old. But you know, the really exciting thing about it, at least for a lot of people, is the fact that the company was actually like 20 years in the making, because it started when I had my two daughters. I was a young mom, and I was actually looking for ways to really make them more marketable in the job market, even though they were children.
I was thinking really early,
right? And, you know, I thought the way to make sure that they were competitive would be to have them passionate and proficient in math and science. So I started looking for resources. But at the time, all of the resources that were around were like really boring and esoteric. And that was a problem for me because I didn't have a STEM background or science and math background. And I thought, if I couldn't get really passionate about these subjects, how would I get my children passionate? So I was working on this other business venture where I developed these logos that were puzzle piece characters. They were brother and sister named Patty and Patrick. And I started doing the research, and I used the puzzle piece characters just to make it a lot more fun and engaging. And then the story fast forwards 20 years later, and something really amazing had happened with my daughters. My youngest daughter was getting a degree in biology, a minor in chemistry, and right now she's actually a fourth-year dental student, so she's going to graduate from UIC in May.
There you go.
Yeah.
So that STEM stuff worked?
Yeah, it worked. And then, you know, but at the time she was really involved in pipeline programs and community science programs to get girls interested in science. So she was very passionate about it. And Kelly, of course, who is now my CEO of Paige and Paxton, She was on the technology and the math end. She had moved to Manhattan and she was working for companies like American Express and JP Morgan Chase. And then she got connected in with the tech community and started holding these amazing events all across the country called hackathons, where she engaged middle school and high school kids in the tech fields. And she was even one of the founding members of the New York chapter of Black Girls Code. So she was like really making an impact. And so, you know, one of the things she noticed is that all of those programs were really awesome, but they started much too late.
Yeah.
And so she was like,
in terms of teaching kids.
Yeah, in terms of teaching kids. Because, you know, and research shows that by the time kids are 8 years old, they've already opted out of certain careers. They've already decided what they really want to be and what they can be. And so she was right. And, you know, the education community was realizing the same thing, is that we were starting much too late in terms of getting kids into what they call STEM now, science, technology, engineering, and math. But, you know, at the time, this was back in 2012, I was like, are you crazy? You know, I just made those little goofy puzzle piece characters for you guys. And she's like, no, no, they worked. You know, I love those characters.
So growing up, Kelly, did you really love those characters growing up, or was it a lot of extra work around the house?
No, I actually really love those characters, because when we actually, around 2011, 2012, when I came home, because I was living in New York and would come home for the holidays, there was one holiday when I actually found them. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what started the conversation. We actually went in the basement, we're cleaning up some things, and I saw the characters, and I was like, oh my goodness, I'm like, it's Patty and Patrick. I love these characters growing up. And my mom was like, really? You like them?
So how does it then, so you have the conversation to say, let's start this curriculum to help younger kids get more interested in it. How does it actually work? Is it about just writing the books? Is it about going into classrooms? How does it actually manifest itself, Paige and Paxton?
Yeah, so with Paige and Paxton, everything starts with a story. So the storybooks, which feature different subject lines. Mm-hmm. So we have like a story that's an intro to science. We have one that is focused on botany, microbiology. I think mom is currently working on one that's on packaging engineering. So we start with the subject matter, and then the way that it kind of manifests itself is through an actual formal curriculum that we provide to teachers. We also provide them to after-school instructors as well, because we have a after-school program that runs Monday through Friday and on Saturdays through a partnership with Blue 1647 called Blue Studios. And then we also have an informal way of presenting the curriculum through parent and children events, and those are called our make-a-thons. And so we held those about once a quarter, once or every other month or so.
Rachel, what's been the response from parents, from teachers, when you introduce this curriculum to them?
Actually, at first, with teachers, they're a little skeptical. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of people probably don't know this, but elementary, people who study elementary education actually have the highest math and science anxiety of any other college major. And some surveys really suggest that the reason they go into elementary education is because they don't have to tackle the hard science and math. And so they're a little skeptical at first, but when we present them to them, as you know, what we say is at Paige and Paxton, our mission is to make STEM easy to teach and easy to learn. And so what makes it easy to learn also makes it easy to teach. And so when teachers are exposed to these lessons that are written in simple, everyday language that they can understand, we also provide science and technical background right there in the lesson. And then you have, you know, these adorable puzzle piece characters and these storylines and everything that bring relevance to every single lesson.
Because at the end of the day, they got to be able to relate and have fun and enjoy the lessons.
Yes.
Kelly, I got to ask so people that it doesn't always happen through the classroom, can people just buy the books offline? How does that work?
Yeah, they can. So they can go to pageandpaxton.com, and we also offer books for sale on Amazon. So,
what age groups are you looking for these kids?
So we go as young as 3 all the way to 5th grade. So that's about 10 years old.
All right. So anyone that's 3 or 10 years old, get online, because these kids these days on those iPads, they'll order stuff for you. But parents, grandparents, aunts and uncles, it's a great way. One more time, the website?
It is www.pageandpaxton.com.
And that's P-A-I-G-E.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Like the girl named Paige.
Exactly. Yeah. Very good. Kelly and Rachel, guys, thanks so much for joining us.
All right. Thank you for having us.
Didn't that go by quick?
Yeah, thank you.
And Rachel, you said you were nervous. You didn't sound nervous at all.
Am I still on?
Yeah, you're still on. Oh, great. I just messed it up. More coming up on the Winter's Business Lunch after this. 720 WGN. John Hansen in for Amy Guth for just another 9 minutes or so as we get up to Northwestern basketball and their huge game today against Michigan State. By the way, before we wrap up the show at the end of it, I'd love if you guys could all give me a little advice out there. 312-981-7200. Text in. I'm actually going to start the process of buying a condo today. I'm looking at places. I got a mortgage lender and all that stuff that is so intimidating and so adult that I never ever thought I'd get to this step. But here in my mid-30s, I feel like it's finally time to do that. So if you have any last pieces of advice before I hit the road, text them in, 312-981-7200. Okay, back to the Wintrust Business Lunch. We're going to be talking right now with Brian Fung. He's a reporter at the Washington Post, and we're talking about this interesting court battle between AT&T and the U.S. government. Brian, thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So just to really quickly catch everyone up in 1 minute, we're talking about the proposed merger between AT&T and Time Warner and the fairly surprising decision that the Justice Department had blocked it. So where is the case at now? And I know you're writing about some really unprecedented situation going on that'll be playing out in the court case.
Yeah, so just as a refresher, you know, this is a really big merger involving AT&T, the one of the nation's biggest wireless carriers, and Time Warner, which owns HBO, CNN, Warner Brothers, and a whole lot of other really lucrative content. So if this merger were to go forward, you know, AT&T would become essentially a media powerhouse and be able to essentially compete with the likes of Google and Netflix by building an advertising empire. So that's essentially the stakes here. The Justice Department has blocked or sought to block the merger, arguing that it could harm competition and hurt consumers. AT&T obviously disagrees. And yesterday, the two sides had a status hearing where you know, the AT&T lawyers tried to push the government to release more evidence to try and prove that President Trump did not involve himself in the review of this merger. If he had, if the evidence does seem to show that, then that could potentially be an example of executive overreach, which would be an illegal use of his authority.
So what are they trying to do now in order to make that case? I understand they're actually going to be bringing an unusual person up to the stand.
Yeah, so earlier this week, we found out that the AT&T side had put on Machen Delrahim, he's the Justice Department's top antitrust enforcer, on a potential list of witnesses that AT&T might call if and when this goes to trial. And that was a big deal because almost no one has ever heard of a defendant in a merger case asking their direct accuser to essentially come to the stand. Now, the two sides on Friday agreed to take Delrahim's name off the list temporarily, but you know, while they're in negotiations here, but his name could still ultimately be added back to the list.
Is that a show of confidence by AT&T in their case? Is it a bargaining chip they're trying to throw on the table to get this thing settled before it has to reach this point? What would be the motivation behind putting his name on the list?
Well, AT&T certainly wants to signal that it has a very strong case. You know, it's essentially going after a very aggressive court strategy, trying to undermine the Justice Department's legitimacy in terms of its ability to actually bring this case to court. And, you know, so by putting Delrahim's name on the list, it raises questions, further questions about what communications may have transpired between him or his agency and the White House.
I know that a lot of people were surprised by the blocking or the attempted blocking of this merger. What was the language? I understand that this person they wanted to put on the stand, the antitrust executive, he in 2016 seemed a lot more favorable towards this than he was when the ruling came, or when the decision kind of came down.
Yeah, in an interview that he'd done with the media, this was before Delrahim was part of the administration. In fact, it was even before President Trump had even been elected. Delrahim said he didn't think that the AT&T deal posed a major antitrust problem. Of course, that's based in this idea among many antitrust experts that, you know, in a deal that involves two companies that don't necessarily don't directly compete, that doesn't necessarily pose a big problem for competition. Obviously, since he took office, Delrahim has changed his mind and is now arguing that this actually does pose a threat to competition.
Brian, last question. What's the timing like moving forward? Where is this? When is this case going to progress? When can we expect to see more news coming out of this?
Well, the two sides are set to go to trial on March 19th, so this is moving along very quickly. But there's still a number of steps that have to be taken between now and then. The two sides are still going through what's known as discovery, meaning that they're trying to gather facts and the evidence that they can then marshal in court to bolster their arguments.
I imagine you'll be covering this as it moves forward. Where can people follow your work? Obviously at thewashingtonpost.com. What's your Twitter handle, Brian, if you're on it?
You can follow me on Twitter at @B_Fung.
All right, Brian, thank you so much for the update on this, and we'll be sure to check in with you later on as we get more, okay?
Thanks for having me.
All right, Brian Fung of The Washington Post updating on that very interesting story between AT&T and Time Warner and that merger that has been blocked and the inside baseball of it all. I don't want to call it inside baseball, but really interesting stuff. A lot of people have theories about why the Trump administration might want to see AT&T and Time Warner not merged. A lot of it has to do with the networks that are associated with those sorts of those two companies, and it'll be interesting to see moving forward where that comes up. All right, before we get to Northwestern basketball really quickly, I'm really excited to share that I've decided to buy in the city of Chicago, something I swore I would never do for years and years, Griffin. It's just, I've been a renter. I've had a really cheap living situation. Sure. I live in like the West Ukrainian village, but my roommate's going to move in with her boyfriend, so I'm losing my place. The point is, I've decided to take that leap. And I got to tell you, I knew it would be complicated, but I was a little unaware at how much, I guess it's naive of me, how much financial stuff has to go into. Are you a renter, Griffin?
I am a renter, yes.
Are you a renter for life, do you feel like, or do you feel like you'll...
No, I don't, but I don't...
It takes a while to get up the capital. Like, I mean, it's...
Oh, yeah, I'm nowhere near buying, certainly.
Right.
It was. I'm struggling to rent at all anyway, so...
Well, that's all. Hey, I was there at the same age. It was an interesting process going forward, and to find a real estate agent, I thought it would be the easiest thing in the world because we hear commercials all the time for them. People solicit, but it was honestly Zillow that got me a real estate agent at the end of the day. I solicited some advice, two quick texts. Make sure you know where your credit score is. Get it as high as you can quickly and easily. That's so true. Luckily, I went through the mortgage pre-approval process, and that was good, but that was a long journey to get my credit score to where you wanted to do.
So you're feeling pretty prepared.
I'm feeling good. I'm feeling prepared, and I talked to a mortgage lender, and I was right in line. But walking through all the numbers of what goes into a mortgage, whether it's the tax assessments, whether it's the HOAs, just trying to figure out what that monthly number would be interesting. And then someone said the 847, bring someone with you. Two sets of eyes are better than one, and have one party keep the realtor busy while you take a really close look at constructions of the unit. So I need a decoy. Griffin, that is the absolute plan. All right, guys, thank you so much for the advice. That'll wrap things up here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. And guess what? It's Northwestern basketball coming up right now on 720 WGN.